Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Patty Lavera of the group Food and Water Watch, who talks about the recent House passage of the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act, which prohibits states from mandating the labeling of foods that contain genetically modified ingredients. J.D. Hansen of the International Center for Technology Assessment, who explains why his group is suing the EPA for its conditional approval of a pesticide product that contains nanoparticles of silver. And New Haven, Connecticut Assistant Police Chief Anthony Campbell, who discusses the need for regular psychological testing of police officers to maintain a force that's practicing ethical and fair law enforcement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Police recruits in the Ruhr Valley in western Germany learn different lessons in disarming suspects than their American counterparts. They learn how to police in dangerous situations without using a gun. German police recruits are usually college graduates who must undergo over 130 weeks of formal training, including law classes and learning about the cultural practices of Muslims. German recruits also engage in extensive training in counterterrorism and how to deal with right-wing anti-immigrant groups. According to the Christian Science Monitor, police shootings are rare in most European countries, Canada, and Japan. Police officers in these industrial nations are better educated, have acquired good communication skills, and are better paid than officers in the U.S., which witnessed over 400 police shootings thus far in 2015. The recently elected left-wing mayor of Barcelona, Spain, Ada Colau, wants to impose a stiff cap on the number of tourists traveling to explore her attractive and historic city. Colau also proposed a moratorium on new hotel licenses soon after she took office in June. Many Barcelona residents have grown tired of the influx of affluent tourists that have driven up housing costs, overcrowded city streets, and caused general disruption of urban life. In New Orleans, the city-backed construction of upscale hotels in the French Quarter during the 1980s and support for new upscale tourist music venues led to a 50% increase in rents. Gentrification left few affordable housing options for the low-income workforce and reduced the number of neighborhood businesses like barbershops and food stores. Tulane University sociologist Kevin Fox Gorham asserts, gentrification and tourism are largely driven by large financial firms and entertainment corporations who have established friendly relations with city government officials and institutions like the local Chamber of Commerce. Jesse Jackson arrived at Google's headquarters in Silicon Valley with a cause and knowledge of what levers to push. At the 2014 Google shareholders meeting, the veteran civil rights leader pressed Google's only top-level black executive, David Drummond, to release its federal data on workforce diversity. For years, Silicon Valley tech giants have resisted calls to make public their worker diversity data, including the number of blacks, Latinos, and women employed at the likes of Apple, Intel, Microsoft, and Facebook. Drummond, an old ally of Jackson, agreed. 2 weeks after the meeting, Google operations executive Laszlo Bock released the data, which showed 30% of Google's workforce were women, 3% Latino, and 2% black. Bock acknowledged, "Google is not where we want to be when it comes to diversity." The data, later made public by other major tech firms, showed less than 10% of tech workers were black or Latino, compared to the 27% of minorities that make up the overall U.S. workforce. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill on July 23rd called the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act, which would ban all states from requiring the labeling of foods that contain genetically engineered ingredients. Supporters of the legislation assert there's no credible evidence that foods produced with biotechnology pose any risk to human health and safety. But the bill's opponents say that GMO foods have not undergone rigorous and thorough unbiased testing, and that consumers should have the right to know what's in the food they're eating, regardless of perceived hazards. Consumer groups have nicknamed the bill the Denying Americans the Right to Know Act, or DARK. The bipartisan vote in the House supporting the bill, 275 to 150, reflected the influence of giant food corporations in Congress, who were looking for a way to overturn legislation passed in Vermont, Connecticut, and Maine, which requires the labeling of GMO foods. Groups like the Grocery Manufacturers Association claim state labeling laws will drive up food costs. While there is not yet a strong base of support for a companion bill in the U.S. Senate, groups who oppose the anti-labeling legislation say the public is on their side in this fight, and they're calling on senators to oppose the measure. Your reporter spoke with Patty Lavera, assistant director with the group Food and Water Watch. Here she talks about the impact of the bill on states that currently have their own food labeling laws and the interests behind this effort to deny consumers basic information about the food they eat.
So far, after a couple of solid years of really good activism at the state level, the grassroots level, Connecticut, Maine, and Vermont have all passed laws out of their legislature that would eventually require GMO foods to be labeled. Connecticut and Maine had kind of a waiting period where they needed other states to pass it as well. Vermont's law is set to go into effect about halfway through next year in 2016, so that is coming. That law has an effective date that's coming would be the first place in the country where it would be mandatory. Mandatory labeling would be required. So not surprisingly, the biotechnology industry, Monsanto and DuPont, and the guys who make these GMO seeds, and the grocery manufacturers, they don't like being regulated at all. They really don't like being regulated in terms of having to disclose things about food production that they don't want to. So when states started to respond to the grassroots and to respond to their citizens by requiring labeling, these big industry players went to Washington and they went to Congress. And so they did a lot of lobbying. They have thrown their weight around and they have convinced the House to pass a bill that would block those state laws, that would say this is a federal job. It's not for the states to do. But the good news is there is no bill yet in the Senate. And so, you know, lots of groups, including Food and Water Watch, were really focused on making sure we don't see this bad legislation move through the Senate.
Now, Patty, as I understand it, the vote for this bill in the U.S. House of Representatives was 275 to 150. It means a lot of Democrats and Republicans all voted for this bill. What kind of money is flowing to these candidates from the big agriculture food companies, as well as companies like Monsanto that specialize in genetic engineering?
Yeah, we're going to see some of that data when we report, you know, from this time period that just happened with this vote. But what we do know is lots and lots of lobbying was going on. You know, all of us in D.C. that were down there doing our meetings, we were seeing folks from the other side doing their meetings too. We know that the same entities, you know, the grocery manufacturers, the biotechnology companies like the Monsantos, they have spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars in states where this has been either in the legislature or on the ballot. So we tallied some of it up last year, and we think that they've spent up, you know, getting close to $100 million. I think we were well over $90 million in the last couple of years fighting state-level initiatives because they really, really, really don't want these bills to go through to change how they have to label their foods. And then they shifted their attention to D.C. So we're going to have to do that analysis when we get through some of the reporting that'll happen. It's a little too early to know, but we know that they put a lot of effort into it, and we know the PR, you know, the public relations war that they waged on this. There was just some really outrageous claims made about the impact that a basic label on a package of food would have on the price of food. That just didn't make any sense, but that didn't stop these companies from saying it over and over and over again that requiring this labeling would somehow dramatically increase all of our grocery bills, which just doesn't make any sense.
In the European Union, for instance, which is, you know, a continent with an economy and standard of living similar to here in the United States, what is their policy on genetically modified foods, their labeling, or even their sale within the European Union?
So a lot of folks think that GMOs are entirely banned in the European Union, and they're actually not, and they're reevaluating their process right now. They're having a very hot debate there right now about how they're going to approve these crops, what's allowed to be cultivated there, what's allowed to be eaten there, but they do have labeling. And so they've had labeling for many, many years, and when things are sold there that contain it, they have to be labeled. As do, you know, lots of other countries around the world, including, you know, really large economies that use GMOs like Brazil. They have figured out how to do this because it's pretty basic information to carry through the supply chain. You know that the seed is genetically engineered, and we're just asking that information carry through the supply chain to the end product.
What are the prospects that the U.S. Senate will take up a similar bill to the one passed in the U.S. House of Representatives to prohibit the labeling of GMO foods? And if it were passed by the Republican-controlled House and Senate, is there any indication that President Obama would either sign or veto such legislation?
Yeah, these are the political questions we're going to be talking about in August. So there is not yet a bill in the Senate. So that's the first step. Someone has to introduce it. There's discussions supposedly happening, but they haven't figured it out yet. You know, historically, when he was campaigning for president, the president talked about we should label GMOs. And so Food and Water Watch and lots of other folks who work on this issue are going to try to hold him to that if we reach that point. If the Senate were to pass a bill and it's up to him to veto it, we're going to be calling on him to live up to that campaign promise. But right now, you know, what we're asking people to do is, depends how much longer they stay, but the Senate's only going to be in D.C. for another week or so, and then they're going to be home for August, and we need folks to be talking to them during that August recess saying, don't do this. You know, don't limit, especially if you're in a place like Connecticut where you have a state law that's eventually going to go into effect. You need to tell, you know, your members of the Senate from Connecticut, don't touch our state laws. Let us figure it out here.
That was Patty Lavera, assistant director with the group Food and Water Watch. Find more news and commentary on the campaign to label GMO foods on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The International Center for Technology Assessment and the Center for Food Safety filed a joint lawsuit against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency on July 27th, challenging the agency's conditional approval of the antimicrobial pesticide product called NanoSilva. The pesticide under scrutiny, which will be used in textiles and plastics, employs nanotechnology that breaks down silver into particles more than 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. Conventional silver has been used as an antibacterial product for centuries, as it releases ions that are deadly for many bacteria and fungi. However, watchdog groups and scientists are increasingly concerned about the growing number of consumer products that contain nanoparticles that could pose unique hazards and long-term risks. Unless new regulations are imposed, nanoparticles of silver may soon be embedded in children's toys, clothing, plastics, and fabrics. The lawsuit filed against the EPA in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals seeks to block the sale of the NanoSilva pesticide in the marketplace without the legally required analysis of the product's effect on human health, wildlife, and the environment. EPA's conditional approval of NanoSilva means that the pesticide can be sold over the next 4 years, while the manufacturer, NanoSilva LLC of Georgia, performs the required testing. Your reporter spoke with J.D. Hansen, policy director with the International Center for Technology Assessment, who discusses his group's lawsuit against the EPA and the health and safety concerns surrounding nanotechnology.
This is a product that is, in this case, it's being approved to go into clothes, it's being approved to go into plastic lumber. It could be on a dock near you. So we're concerned that, you know, when this is stuck into plastic lumber, it's going to leach out. It's intended to leach out. And it will affect aquatic life right around it. The recent study in 2015 by University of California, Davis, looking at nanocopper, found that sea urchins were badly affected by this. So we want to see good data being used to approve these products. We're not saying this product should never be on the market. We're saying that the company and the EPA need to finish doing their research on it, though.
Now, just to go back to some of the basics, because I know I had a hard time just trying to understand the nature of nanotechnology in these products. As I understand it, these particles that are manufactured are smaller than anything found in nature. If you could explain the size of these molecules and by their very size, what threat they pose to human health and aquatic life, as you said.
If you took one nanometer and lined it up across your hair on your head, you could line up 10,000 of them. So it is; these things are really, really small. The problem is they're small enough to get into your cells, They're even small enough to get into the nucleus of your cells. So this is why they work good to kill microbes, because they get inside them and kill them. We want to be sure that they're not getting inside you. They're not getting inside of plants and organisms in the environment that they shouldn't be. And we want to see the test that that demonstrate that, and that's what we're asking for.
J.D., what can you tell us about existing regulations when it comes to nanotechnology products? What regulations are there at present?
Well, the regulations aren't so good. And most of the agencies that are trying to regulate nanoproducts are using what they call guidances, which aren't really laws. They're just statements by the agency that says this is how we're going to be reviewing your product. The pesticide products, we are arguing, do need to go through the normal pesticide review, and should be considered a new pesticide because of their small size. Silver has been approved for a long time, but nanosilver, we argue, is a different product, and it should go through its own approval process, which is a clear process. Unfortunately, the EPA is choosing to use conditional registration rather than the full registration, which fast-tracks the approval. And the General Accounting Agency of the government has criticized EPA for using this for pesticides in general, to the point that the EPA has even lost lots of its files on conditional registration. We don't like the process to begin with, and we think now that this is the third pesticide that's going through this process, and two others were by another company.
J.D. Hansen, are there other countries in the world who have implemented regulations to better control nanotechnology and its possible ill effects on human health and the environment?
Well, Europe is starting to do so, and Europe has a new law that they're just implementing that would require for food that you label it if it's got nano in it. We would rather not have it in it at all, but that's a step in the right direction. And they have a law that governs, three different laws govern chemicals, pesticides, and biocides. And all of them require a lot of data about nanomaterials before they're approved.
One big question that surrounds a lot of new technology and versus regulation is profit versus public health, safety, and the environment. Are the folks manufacturing nanotechnology products, do they have deep pockets to effectively fight the imposition of regulation to protect human health and the environment?
Well, many of them do. You know, I mean, all of the big food companies are involved in this. All of the big chemical companies are involved in this. And though, to some extent, they're holding back a bit, waiting to see what happens to the little guys like this NanoSilva company in Georgia. What they often do is they buy up the ones that work out and ignore the ones that don't.
That was J.D. Hansen, Policy Director with the International Center for Technology Assessment. Find links to more information on the hazards of nanotechnology and the EPA's approval of products containing nanoparticles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Once a week, or more often, America wakes up to another police killing of an unarmed African-American man or woman. The deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Eric Garner in New York City, and many others at the hands of police gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement last year, which challenged a law enforcement and judicial system that was unresponsive to obvious cases of racial bias. A panel discussion titled Sorry It's the Law, that was held on July 28th in New Haven, Connecticut, addressed the topic of race relations examined through the lens of police officers' behavior. Among the panelists were a criminal defense attorney, two African-American members of the Connecticut General Assembly, a community activist, an official with the American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut, and the New Haven Police Department's assistant police chief. Many stories were told about area citizens being stopped for the so-called crime of driving while black, including incidents where officers falsified the race of the person stopped in the report as white in order to hide the common practice of racial profiling. New Haven Assistant Police Chief Anthony Campbell, who's African American, has been a police officer for 18 years. In this excerpt from his talk, Chief Campbell explains the psychological testing process used to weed out officers who may be unfit to serve. But although this testing is only conducted during the hiring process, he noted that once an officer is on the force, prejudices and hostility towards specific communities can change over time, which often leads to serious problems.
When an officer exhibits they're not fit for duty because they've got a high number of excessive force allegations, or we're getting reports from other officers or the community that they don't seem to be psychologically sound, we put them up for what's called a fitness for duty evaluation. They're sent to be evaluated through employee assistance program. They sit down with a psychiatrist. We send them through medical testing, see what's going on. Now, it is very hard to fire a police officer. Police officer may get fired, but may get their job back. And it's because a lot of arbitrators, and the way our system is set up is we vet police officers extremely well up front. If you get someone who can make it through that vetting process, they're a pretty stable person. Like the legislator said, they're not going to admit they're a racist person. They're not going to admit that they may be misogynistic. They're not going to admit certain things. But the psychological testing will show if they have certain tendencies, if they're more likely to have issues down the line. But we do that once. I've been on the job 18 years. I had that test 19 years ago.
Wow.
And since then, I've been hit by a car. I've been shot at. I've been, you name it. And I never had any psychological testing after that. Now, fortunately, I'm smart enough to know that once a week I should be sitting on somebody's couch. And I'm smart enough, you know what I mean? And I'm smart enough to know that, you know, if something's bothering me, I need to talk to someone. But everyone, you know, and especially in the culture of policing, that can be viewed as weakness. That can be viewed as, well, you're supposed to man up and toughen up. I think there's great strength in talking. I think there's great strength in understanding that no man is an island unto himself. So, yes, the psychological testing, you know, I think, you know, one of the things our chief talks about is officer wellness. Police officers are recruited from the community. And, you know, when you look at statistically, the number one people who kill themselves other than military are police. Easy access to the weapon, highest level of divorce, second only to actors. And officers kill themselves on a regular basis. Just had an assistant chief kill himself 2 months ago. And it happens all the time because there is no psychological testing. There is no system designed to make sure that the people who are taking care of the community, who see the worst of humanity on a daily basis, are themselves being taken care of. And so it filters back into the community in excessive force, in implicit bias, in racism, because the system itself, not just the systems with regard to criminal justice, but the system itself with policing, it has to be changed. And we're chipping away at it little by little. The one thing you'll find, you go to any police department, a cop cannot stand change. They can't stand it. But they can't stand the way things are. And you look at that and go, but wait a minute, that's diametrically opposed. Yes, it is, but it's the reality. And so you chip away at the things you can. You change your internal affairs policies. You make it 7 days a week. You make it so that we'll come out and take the complaint from you. You start really putting tracking systems in place so that when a taser is used, when a baton is used, any use of force from pepper spray or what have you. You want a supervisor to be on scene. You want an use of force report to be generated so that three branches of the police department can look at this so that we start tracking officers and seeing what's going on. We're trying. We're doing what we can to make it better, but there's a lot more that can be done. You can have someone who's on the job, say 5-6 years, and you're getting reports that they're aggressive, or that, you know, they're locking everybody up, or they're threatening certain people. Chief gets wind of it, or we have certain programs that track it, and you pull them in and you talk to them. You may even send them for fitness for duty testing, and they say, no, they're fit for duty. They have some issues that need to be worked on. They work on those issues, and then they get released back into the community. When you're on this job, you can tell the officers who are just burnt out. They're tired. They work in hard neighborhoods. They've been bounced around. They have certain difficulties. But those difficulties may not necessarily rise to the level of you as an administrator have a right to send them for fitness for duty testing. One of the biggest things is that most police departments, the police officers are protected by a union. And that union is there to make sure that the officers, their rights, aren't taken advantage of. But it also creates yet one more barrier. I may know an officer has a problem. I may know that an officer is a little bit too aggressive or isn't in line with the philosophy we may have of community policing. But there are only certain tools that I have. Now, if let's say it was mandated that every 5 years an officer has to have psychological testing, that becomes one more tool that I, as a police chief and an administrator, can use to ensure that my officer is mentally sound. And if he needs help, he or she needs help, then we can get them the help that they need. Officers in the culture of policing are highly reluctant to seek help, because they have this mentality that if they seek help, then they're going to lose their gun, they're going to not be able to work and make money the way they want to, they're not going to be viewed in a positive light by their peers, and so there's great resistance.
That was Assistant Chief of Police Anthony Campbell of the New Haven Police Department, speaking at a July 28th public forum titled, Sorry, It's the Law. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more perspectives on fair and ethical law enforcement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.